Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This was yet another day when the stock markets went cockeyed. Just as it's been for the past 2 months, Wall Street was a barometer of economic unease. And down in Washington, Congress continued its search for answers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, committed to providing health and wellness services through its executive health program at clevelandclinic.org/executive health. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 13th of November. It's a Thursday, and it is great, as always, to have you with us. There wasn't so much fallout from the financial crisis on Wall Street today as there was fall up. When it got going this morning, it looked for all the world like another sad music day on Wall Street. Somewhere around lunchtime, though, traders changed their minds and decided to start buying. All in all, it was a 900-point swing for the Dow, from where its lows were to where it closed, up better than 6.5%. Hedge funds have been blamed for a lot of the crazy volatility that's been hammering the markets in September. That goes a long way to explaining why some high-profile hedge fund managers, including billionaire George Soros, had their turn at the long green witness table on Capitol Hill today. Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Hedge funds helped send the Dow down 14% last month. Investors forced them to sell stock as they withdrew their money. Hedge funds invested in credit default swaps, contracts that insure investments if they go sour. The swaps helped bring down Lehman Brothers. Republican Congressman Tom Davis of Virginia questioned the role of hedge funds today.
Hedge funds now pose very public peril when the bets go bad.
What to do about those bad bets? California Democrat Henry Waxman chairs the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. He asked the hedge fund managers what they thought.
Do you believe that the collapse of large hedge funds could pose systemic risks to the economy? And if so, do you believe this justifies greater federal regulation?
George Soros said yes.
But we must beware of going overboard with regulation.
He and some of the other fund managers supported the idea of a new public clearinghouse to keep track of credit default swaps, which are often traded. Kenneth Griffin is founder and CEO of the Citadel Investment Group.
Regulators will have far greater transparency into this vast and important market.
Other hedge fund executives said they would support stricter disclosure requirements for their investments. Events may be getting ahead of them. On the other side of Capitol Hill today, Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said he'd reintroduce legislation to require hedge funds to register with the Securities and Exchange Commission. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It's been, I don't know, maybe 3 months since I've had the guts to take a peek at my retirement account statement. Maybe today in the markets got us all just a little bit of money back for our golden years. But otherwise, boy, it's been bad. Much of the blame goes to corporate and public pension funds. They invested heavily in the real estate market. Really heavily. The California Public Employees Retirement System, better known as CalPERS, says its real estate portfolio lost more than a third of its value. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports public pension funds all over the country are feeling the same squeeze.
CalPERS lost nearly $70 billion between June of last year and June of this year, much of it in real estate. CalPERS's Pat Mock says the fund got blindsided along with everybody else.
You know, no one, not the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury, nobody believed that the market change would be as severe or as swift.
Mock says the fund still holds more than $180 billion, plenty to pay out its obligations for many years to come. But if the markets don't recover soon, funds like CalPERS could be in a lot of trouble, says Olivia Mitchell, director of the Pension Research Council at the Wharton School of Business.
There's a huge controversy in pension land about exactly how pension money should be invested.
Mitchell says over the past decade, pensions started to take more risks to cover the rising cost of benefits. They put money into real estate, hedge funds, and private equity firms. Mitchell says many of the funds still don't know how bad their losses will be. But she says if CalPERS and funds like it don't recover in the next few years, they'll have to start scrounging for money.
The taxpayers will have to pay more. Potentially even the employees will have to pay more.
That could mean bigger employee contributions to health care coverage and smaller payouts to retirees. Those changes could have a major impact on the 13 million Americans on pension plans, like retired teacher Gene Walsdorf.
We need the money. It is very important that when you get older, you need that support.
Walsdorf, who is 56, says he has a child starting college next year. He says if his benefits get cut, it would be devastating to his family. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Walmart reported third quarter earnings today. Profits were up, the world's biggest retailer, as consumers went looking for bargains. But the company also said the future is not going to be quite as bright. Stores are marking down merchandise like it's December 26th out there, so the bargains are almost impossible to resist. Of course, that's the idea, lure you in and then let your impulses take over. But Beth Titel reports those feel-good purchases may not feel so good once you get them out of the store.
First, there were fashionistas, then recessionistas, and now meet the returnistas.
I actually think sometimes I am happier when I'm returning than when I'm actually buying.
That's Bobby Zimmerman, a retiree from Needham, Massachusetts, describing the relief she feels when she brings back the very items she spends her days buying.
It really is like a weight off my chest sometimes.
Zimmerman is engaging in the newest fashion trend, circle shopping, and it goes like this. Buy something, stress about it, return it, rejoice, and repeat. Buyer's remorse is leading to a record-setting amount of returns.
For the big figure for 2008, retailers are expecting to receive almost $220 billion in returns. According to our records, it's the largest return amount we've seen in history.
That's Joseph LaRocca, Vice President of Loss Prevention with the National Retail Federation. Some consumers are hunting through their closets looking for things to bring back. But for others, the urge to return strikes before they even leave the mall. Betty Riaz, owner of the Steel Boutique outside of Boston, watched one customer boomerang.
So she came into the store and she bought a $225 belt. She walked out. Exactly 36 minutes later, she came back. She said, I cannot do this. I cannot do this. I need to return the belt.
Riaz disregarded the store's exchange-only policy and refunded the woman's money, an outcome that left Riaz unhappy and armed the shopper with fresh cash to start the cycle all over again. In Boston, this is Beth Titel for Marketplace.
Speaking of shopping, it was good old-fashioned bargain hunting on Wall Street today. Lots of it, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Barack Obama announced today that he's going to resign from the Senate effective Sunday. That clears the way for the governor of Illinois to appoint a replacement for him. Obama, of course, has some appointing to do, too. Thousands of political jobs are waiting to be filled in the new administration. If you want one of them, though, you'd best be prepared to come clean. Thanks to the New York Times today, we've gotten a copy of the questionnaire the transition team is sending out. 7 pages, 63 questions, no stone left unturned. Marketplace's Rico Galliano has more on how the Obama administration is trying to avoid surprises.
You think reformatting your resume for a new job is a hassle? Try applying to work in the White House.
My name is Larry Haas. I was communications director for Vice President Al Gore.
Haas recalls the vetting process for that gig, endless reams of paperwork, and, of course, the background check.
Agents are coming around and they're asking your neighbors whether you're an upstanding citizen and all the rest.
Like FBI agents?
Yes, the FBI is doing a background check.
But Haas says compared to today's application process, his experience was a breeze.
I just think there's a greater sensitivity now to self-induced public embarrassment.
And there are now so many more ways to publicly embarrass yourself. During the campaign, bloggers had a field day with info gleaned from the MySpace page of Levi Johnston, Sarah Palin's future son-in-law. Not surprisingly, the Obama transition team is asking job applicants to disclose every piece of electronic communication that could come back to haunt the president-elect. That puts most folks out of the running, including me, at least according to my pal Tim. Tim, I'm thinking of applying for a job in the Obama White House.
Okay.
You think I got a shot?
Rico, I mean, there's plenty of stuff with you on the internet. I know there's video of you impersonating a clergyman giving a prayer at the grilled cheese cooking competition. It's no Jeremiah Wright, but it's...
I was doing a fake prayer in praise of cheese. That was good, clean fun.
Well, you know, look who's laughing now.
By the way, I contacted a few serious applicants for positions in the Obama White House. They had no comment. They didn't want to say anything that would hurt their application. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
For the political class, the best game in Washington is trying to guess who's going to get which high-level job come January. We're not talking about principal deputy assistant secretary of anything here. There is one job right now that is first among equals. Commentator John Steele Gordon offers this set of qualifications.
At the beginning of the new administration, the second most important job will be that of Secretary of the Treasury. So who should get that job? I hope the president chooses someone with long and deep experience in the financial industry, not an economics professor or a career government official. Theoretical knowledge or expertise at playing the bureaucratic game are all well and good. But what is needed right now is what Henry Paulson had in spades, boots-on-the-ground experience with how the financial system works in the real world. Paulson spent 32 years with Goldman Sachs, climbing the greasy pole all the way to the chairmanship. He knew Wall Street and the banking business inside out. This proved invaluable when the crisis came. Many blame the private financial sector for the current economic problems. But even if that were true, experience there shouldn't be disqualifying. Indeed, it would be a plus. When the Securities and Exchange Commission was established in 1934, FDR chose Joseph P. Kennedy as its first commissioner. Kennedy had made millions manipulating stocks in the anything-goes 1920s and amassed a larger fortune shorting stocks as they plunged into the abyss of the Great Depression. The left was horrified at Roosevelt's choice. Newsweek wrote that Mr. Kennedy, former speculator and pool operator, will now curb speculation and prohibit pools. The Senate delayed his confirmation to see what he would do on the job. At the end of 6 months, it quietly and unanimously confirmed him for the excellent job of getting the SEC on its feet. Kennedy, you see, knew where the bodies were buried, where market tactics were good for insiders, but not for the system as a whole. Kennedy knew what reforms were needed. That's exactly the sort of person we need at Treasury right now, a fox who knows the weak spots in the henhouse.
John Steele Gordon is a financial and business historian. His most recent book is called An Empire of Wealth. Do take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. The link to click on is that one that says contact. Coming up, the price China pays for its export economy.
So you damage your rivers, you damage your beautiful environment, you damage your air quality. You're basically promoting your growth at the cost of your future generations.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow dipped below 8,000 today at one point, but that magic number seemed to spark a buying frenzy, and it was all good from there. The Dow Industrials jumped 552.6 2/3%, closed at 8,835, the Dow's third largest point gain ever, by the by. The NASDAQ rose 97.6.5%, ended the day at 1596. The S&P 500 climbed 46 points, about 5.5%, finished at 899. National Semiconductor charged up 9.1%. Hewlett-Packard rose 1.8%, despite slashing their projected earnings. Intel rose 6.7%, despite cutting $1 billion from its sales forecast. Crude oil sported up to $58 a barrel. That had Chevron, Hess, and ConocoPhillips all striking double-digit percentage gains today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the October retail sales report. A House committee takes a look at how those bailout funds are being used. And on November 14, 1972, the Dow Jones hit a milestone, topping 1,000 for the first time. It took 76 years to make it that far. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. 2 straight months of living in financial crisis mode isn't really healthy. Not if you want to get the bigger picture of how we got into this mess and how we might get out of it. Starting today, we're going to step back a little bit and have some conversations about the longer view in a series we're calling Taking Stock. As we look around at the state of the global economy, it's pretty clear we've all been spending way too much money. You and me, Wall Street, and governments too. That spending and the debt that goes with it kind of puts an exclamation point on the financial crisis. And here's a great example. Just today, the Treasury Department said the budget deficit for October topped $230 billion. That's the highest monthly total ever. And it's happening because Washington is starting to pay out all those billions in bailout money. Economist Ann Pettifor knows a good deal about debt, and she has done something about it, too. She led a successful effort back in the late 90s to cancel third world debt. And then she wrote a book called The Coming First World Debt Crisis. I asked her how she saw it coming.
I had been working for 10 years on the debt crises of poor countries and middle-income countries, countries like Argentina. And the more I looked at the whole global financial system and tried to understand why it was that countries had got themselves into this mess, the more I realized that actually the debts of the poorest countries were quite small relative to the debts of rich countries like my own, Britain and the United States. The United States and Britain had moved from being the world's creditors from 1945 to 1970. We were both effectively creditors to the rest of the world. And then after that, we became the world's biggest debtors.
Isn't it sort of okay for countries that have large economies and great economies of scale to have that debt?
It is, of course, okay to borrow, but it's not okay to have a global financial system in which there are grave imbalances, where one country will have a big deficit like the United States and Britain, and other countries like China will have an enormous surplus. When these get out of sync, they're likely to just implode.
What was the mechanism? How did it come to be that the United States and the UK and other Western economies had such great debts?
What happened between 1945 and 1971, we lived within a framework known as the Bretton Woods framework, which had been constructed by Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, and John Maynard Keynes and others after the war, as a way of preventing the crisis of the 1920s and the 30s. It ensured that when a country built up a deficit, it was then required to, if you like, structurally adjust its economy, cut back and restore itself to balance. And this happened until the 1970s, when the United States began to get into deficit, very largely because of the Vietnam War, and began to run out of gold, because, of course, Bretton Woods was anchored in gold. And President de Gaulle of France, for example, was demanding to be paid for his exports in gold. And so what happened was economists came to President Nixon and said, we have a problem here. And President Nixon said, well, why bother to give gold? Why not just offer them dollars, greenbacks? And they said, well, if you did that, this would break up the Bretton Woods system. And there'd been some strains in the system then too. And he said, well, let's do that. With the abandonment of gold, the IMF was charged with finding an alternative to gold. And eventually they came up with the idea of using US Treasury bills. Now, a Treasury bill is an IOU. And today, poor countries, rich countries all over the world keep these IOUs in the vaults of their central banks. But what that also meant was the United States was then able to just issue these IOUs almost without limit and live off that money, that borrowed money.
And did that give rise then to the debt crisis that we're in now?
Well, what it did was it meant that the United States did not have to structurally adjust its economy and restore it to balance. It was acting, if you like, as the world's banker. And then at the same time, internally and domestically as an economy, the United States was building up individual, household, and corporate debts. So it was a sort of double whammy, really.
One of the things you have done was to organize a massive debt relief movement. About $100 billion of debt was written off by the G8. And yet here we are now, 8 years later, with the International Monetary Fund going around and, at the request of a lot of these countries who are in some trouble, handing out tens of billions of dollars in more debt. Do you think we're getting ourselves in a situation as we try to get out of this financial crisis where some sort of debt relief might again be needed?
I certainly do. And one of the things I campaigned for very passionately was for a new international framework to deal with the insolvency of countries, a recognition that some countries do go bust. Iceland has gone bust. And if they're bust, they must be treated in the way we'd treat Macy's or any other company. I remember Macy's going bust in the 90s.
But it's one thing, though, wouldn't you say, for Macy's to go broke, and it's another thing for an entire government and a country to go broke?
Well, it isn't really. I mean, we looked to the United States because the United States has got Chapter 11, but it's also got Chapter 9, which dealt, for example, with Orange County, which is, if I'm not mistaken, a county not far from where you mm-hmm, are, mm-hmm. and dealt also with other municipal crises, with governmental debts. And they are different animals completely. But the point is, a civilized society finds a way of resolving and restructuring a debt crisis so as not to destroy the debtor, but to allow it to come back into the economy and play an active part. And I've always argued we'll never get an insolvency framework as long as it's poor countries or small countries like Iceland that needs one. But as soon as a rich country gets into difficulties, and I don't see that as being very far off, suddenly we'll start talking about a framework.
Since you saw this debt crisis coming, I wonder if you see a way out. What has to happen?
I say that we have to put finance back into its box. We have to say to the bankers, thank you, you do us a great service, but your role is to mobilize our savings and to allocate those savings efficiently and appropriately. And we are going to regulate you, and we're not just going to regulate the rate at which you create credit, but we're also going to regulate the way in which you move money around. If government is to be able to do something about borrowing costs and to manage the crisis, then it's going to have to do something about capital flows and about the creation of credit. So that's my answer, and I don't see any other way out of this.
Anne Pettifor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Anne Pettifor. She's a fellow with the New Economics Foundation in London. She's also the author of a book called The Coming First World Debt Crisis. To hear more from our interview about how governments can deal with global debt, check our website. It's marketplace.org. Phrases like capital flows and insolvency frameworks can be tricky to wrap your brain around, but debt imbalances and how they happen become much easier to understand if you define your terms the right way, by talking about, say, iPods and credit cards instead. Because global trade's not a one-way street. Somebody's got to sell before we can buy, and most often that seller is China. China plays a huge part in this country's consumption and borrowing binge, while until fairly recently Chinese consumers haven't been buying much of anything. But Chinese savers plus Western spenders might add up to trouble for both sides. To explain, Marketplace's Scott Tong starts us off in southwestern China.
Yunnan province is home to Wang Ji. He's a 28-year-old office worker and an amateur rock climber. Every month, Wang saves nearly 30% of each paycheck. He learned to be thrifty from his folks in the bathroom.
When you are done the washroom thing, you just press the flush, right? That's it. But parents think, oh, you can save some money. Normally, they do not use the flush.
Saving water means saving money. You get the idea.
My parents always told me that if you want to save the money, you have to save it everywhere.
Wang is a great saver. But by definition, it also means he's a bad spender. Here's why it's bad. Let's take MP3 players as an example. This is one of Wang's favorite rap songs, by the way. Since Chinese consumers don't buy enough iPods, Chinese factories have to export most of them. In fact, the government gives those factories some special help. Cheap land, cheap energy, and other subsidies. Economist Frank Song is with Hong Kong University.
So that adds to the competitiveness of Chinese products. So those things were produced at an artificially cheap price and sold to the industrialized countries.
This developed into a kind of economic codependency. China got addicted to selling, and Europe and America got addicted to buying. Now, here's where it got worse. When China ships out exports, it gets a big stack of foreign currency in return.
It's more than $1.9 trillion.
Michael McCormack is with a consultancy, Z Bend Advisors.
And it has to find a home someplace. You can't leave it lying around. A lot of it has gone into purchasing U.S. treasuries.
Translation, the U.S. dollars you spend on your iPod went to China and then did a U.E. They recycled back in the form of loans, which meant easy money for U.S. borrowers.
Whether it's through mortgages, whether it's through credit cards, the U.S. consumer thought, 2.5% for 10 years? Why not? I'll have a go.
But this whole imbalance hasn't been so great for China either.
And now we realize this is hurting us as well.
Again, Frank Song of Hong Kong University. He says as China overproduced, it also overpolluted.
So you damage your rivers, you damage your beautiful environment, you damage your air quality. You're basically promoting your growth at the cost of your future generations.
If there's any silver lining to this, it's that this unsustainable relationship may have ended since global trade has cratered. The U.S. now needs to live on less consumption, and China has to retool as well and wean itself off exports. So where will future growth come from? That brings us back to Wang Ji, the rock climber. He and his wife are dropping $30 at a Shanghai restaurant, which is exactly what Beijing wants to see. Consumption, American style. Now, Wang started out as a saver, but he sure sounds willing to defect.
As young people, you know, the most important thing is life. Enjoy your life.
His wife next to him cradles an expensive purse. It's Coach brand. Inside that purse sits a credit card that her mom and dad don't know about. Good start. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
Couple of final notes. First, Warren Buffett squeaked one out today. For the first time in 2 years, shares in his holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, dipped below $100,000 apiece. They rallied, though, along with the rest of the market, almost $103,000, if you want one. And this from Europe, Legos, it seems, cannot be trademarked. Not their shape, anyway. A court over there ruled today that the bricks have to be shaped the way they are to work the way they do. So, no dice. Who knew? That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow rose 552 points on another crazy day, 6.67%. The NASDAQ gained 97 points, 6.5%. The S&P 500 added 46 points. That is 5.5%. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, hedge fund investors line up to cash out.
Spread out over a longer point of time, that kind of liquidity demand may not matter, but isolated at a point in time, in the short run can matter a lot because you may see some fire sales.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.